I figure you're still getting things connected, right?
I'm still getting things connected, and but at the, in the meantime, you may not know this, but I could hear you, and
Oh, okay.
you being very patient and not just sitting there. Okay, Lynn, where are you? Are you going to answer? Lynn, where are you? None of that. No, just patiently, just sitting.
Well, it's kind of like oh, I don't know. The hurrying what's inevitable along, seems kind of silly, so.
Well, good. Well, Bruce Rawls, good morning. Welcome everyone to the House of the Rising Sun with Lynn Johnson, Bruce Rawls, and this morning we're going to talk about what, Bruce? What is the theme of the day? And oh, Cheryl Kaplan says, "Good morning, Bruce," and
Good
she's
morning, Cheryl and all. Yes,
yes.
and Lynn, of course. And you know what? I just read the chronological workbook lesson, and I was reminded. And I was just starting to look up because I know it's in the text as well. That what I call the three R's of forgiveness: the reveal, release, and replace process. And I think lesson 23 really covers that nicely. Should we? Since I know a lot of people, do the chronological. 365 starting on January 1st approach to the to workbook lessons. And so it may be redundant considering
Oh
how
no,
many other people are doing it,
it's
but
never done it.
I
No.
always figure there's so much there. And I've been doing it again, second consecutive year in a row, going through chronologically. And they just get deeper and deeper and deeper each time, they don't they? I mean, it's amazing. So do you want to just read lesson 23 together, and then we can find
Absolutely.
maybe find that place in the course that, perhaps some of the listeners. I'm not watching the chat window because it basically creates a acoustic feedback for me. But maybe you, if you're watching it, you could, if somebody else remembers where in the text those are, or maybe you remember that the three steps of forgiveness are. It's somewhere in the text.
It's actually many places in the text, but maybe not
Right.
out that way. And everyone's saying we love hearing multiple takes on the day's lesson.
Oh,
I
okay,
was going
great.
to say I have Paltalk open, but I have the room muted. I have
Oh,
to mute
okay.
the room, or else I would get feedback too, and we'd be hearing
Oh,
echoes of
okay,
people
yeah,
as
all
well.
right.
So you can be here, but
Okay.
you know, it's that's up to you. So yes. Today's lesson, we were just talking about that, how cool today's lesson is, and how much this really is instructive. I mean, this is seriously instructive on how to be a miracle worker, how to do the work of making a miracle. So, do you want to read?
Sure. Lesson 23 starts, I can escape the world for, I can escape from the world I see by giving up attack thoughts. The idea for today contains the only way out of fear that will ever succeed. Nothing else will work. Everything else is meaningless. But this way cannot fail. Every thought you have makes up some segment of the world you see. It is with your thoughts, then, that we must work if your perception of the world is to be changed. And that's it. I mean, isn't it? And that's the only way that'll work. I mean, I think that's such an important reminder that we keep trying all these, ultimately pathetic and silly approaches to trying to make our dream existence as seemingly separate individuals work, and usually at the expense of someone or something, and it just never satisfies it, let alone works. So.
Well, yeah, and the thing is with all of this, is that amazingly enough to me, students of A Course in Miracles will read this, will study this, will talk about this, will do this, and yet will go looking for something else as soon as it's over. You know,
Oh,
go
yeah.
go try to find something else. You know, I know that no, that's just too simple, so I think that, you know, I'm going to instead, you know, take a class, join a club, you know, become a political activist, or, you know, I'm gonna, you know, the world, the things that's going on in the world is hurting me, so let me see, how I can make myself feel better, get rid of the guilt that I feel for not changing the world, and let's see if I can do it my way, and let's see if this Jesus character, he might not know everything, and I might know something more. So, you know, if I go and rally for Bernie Sanders, then that's going to alleviate the pain in the world.
I think you're bringing up some really, really, you know, potent and loaded subject material in terms of what the Course and certainly a lot of other, you know, Course luminaries, I guess you could say, to talk about is level confusion. And I think that's such a ripe realm to get into, because the whole idea of level confusion is that we basically are trying to, as the Course says, you know, bring the light into the darkness instead of bringing the darkness to the light. And that's just a metaphor for we're trying to fix the dream that says I'm a separate person apart from the rest of the universe, and I've got to take care of my stuff first at the expense of or in prep, you know, overriding any other concerns. And it doesn't mean that we, you know, a few minutes ago, I just brushed my teeth, you know, I mean, it's like, and used the toilet. I mean, like, it doesn't mean we don't do those things, because if we stop doing those things, first of all, our mouth would feel funny and it would start to smell bad, you know, I mean, things would get backed up.
Well, yeah.
And literally and figuratively, I mean, if we don't take care of the things in our dream world that we need to address, and it'd be silly to not do the things that relate to our careers, our families, our health and well-being, and all that stuff. And the Course is, but the Course is never about behavior. That's such an important thing. But we all forget that just so quickly. You know, like Ken says, Ken Wapnick says, you know, when people would go to his workshops and classes and academy classes, and he'd say, as soon as you walk through that door, there's an invisible vacuum that's going to suck this awareness out of your head. You know, and he was being silly, but you know, it's not a bad metaphor, because
it's true,
because you know. Because the instant we, you know, step away from the computer where we're looking at something having to do with you know, thoughts along these lines, or just shift to another window on the same machine, or you know, think, oh, I got to take care of this. There's nothing wrong with taking care of those things or shifting to a different task or whatever. But the challenge is to stay mindful and to stay non-condemning of oneself as we shift our mental attention to the you know, all the demands of the day. And that, I think that's where there's another section that I particularly like in lesson, I think it's 136, the one about sickness is a defense against the truth.
136 is about ripe. That's a great,
yeah, I mean, yeah. But there's a part in there that Ken emphasizes in some of his talks I thought was brilliant, that is sort of glossed over, and a lot of people just jump to the title and emphasize, you know, the biological aspects of sickness is really the double shield of oblivion, which is basically the idea that the outer world, everything having to do with space and time and bodies and personalities and yada yada yada, you know, anything that can change, anything that seems to be different from anything else. And that covers a lot of ground if you take into account space-time differences, individuality, personality, bodies, matter, energy, the whole material universe as we think of it. That's what the Course refers to as the outer shield of oblivion. And that outer shield is the ego's first line of defense. It's like, if I can keep my individual mind busy, my seemingly separate mind busy with all the firefighting activities it has of I got to take care of this, got to take care of that. And it doesn't mean we don't do them, but if we can do them with a more relaxed attitude and say, oh, okay, well, whatever's next, you know, I'll allow myself to be guided, you know, to be peaceful. Not, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The real question about all of that is, what is the purpose? Why am I doing this?
Yes.
And
yes.
So if I'm doing it because I decided that, bad things are happening and I need to do something about it, then my purpose is not peace. My purpose is not joy, and my purpose is not the Holy Spirit's purpose, because the Holy Spirit never does anything because bad things are happening. The Holy Spirit does things because it's the purpose of the plan. And so what my take on this is right back again where in the Manual for Teachers it says, give up all judgment and ask at every moment, what do I really want? And so that's it. What do I really want? If I ask that very simple question before I go off and do anything, even brush my teeth.
Right.
And actually I do that, Bruce. It's crazy. But you know, this morning I woke up and I know that on Saturday morning I can sleep in a half an hour because Joan reads the I'm sorry, Joni, but this is really good for me. I can sleep in an extra half an hour because Joni reads the weekly, all the lessons of the week, kind of a compilation of it. And so I'm laying there in bed and I'm awake and I'm asking the question, what do I want? Do I want to get up and go and see what's going on? Do I want to lay here and rest? Do I want to meditate? You know, I'm not giving myself these choices, although these are the choices coming to my mind. I'm just asking, what do I want? And then it comes very clear to me, oh, I want to get up and come and listen to Joan. And so, and that's what I did. I got up, made a cup of tea, came in here and listened to the rest of Joan finishing up. So, but if I had just said, oh, I really want to go back to sleep. I really want to go. Really, I should be going back to sleep. I have an extra half an hour. I should be, you know, then I'm doing what I want. And it's in those very simple things. You know, do I need, is it time to brush my teeth? I'm prompted to do it. I'm prompted to do things and I don't question. That's the difference. It's when I'm questioning and asking, you know, do I want this or do I want that, that I'm causing myself heartburn. And that's where the 136 business comes in, because it has like a little test. I think it's 136 that has a test of how you can tell whether or not it's right or true or what you need to do. Reality, it's the test of reality. Is that in 136?
I'm not sure, but I know there's a test in there that, you know, am I at peace, you know, and how do I feel?
Oh,
and that to me is always the acid test, is am I at peace about what I'm, you know, doing or think, you know, and doing is just a reflection of what we're thinking. So it's really, you know, is this thought system working for me?
Right.
Basically what it boils down to.
Am I at peace thing then too is the, what is it that of all these things that I could be doing, what is it that I really want to do?
Right.
And then when I recognize that what I really want to do is, you know, come and listen to Joan, that's what I do.
Yeah.
So I, you know, and there's no more question about it. And there's no me sitting here in this chair going, ooh, I could be sleeping still. No, none of that. It's like, oh, this is perfect. This is where I'm supposed to be. So even in these little things, these little choices, and I think it's 156 that has the test of truth. So I was getting, I always get 30s and 50s mixed up. So anyway, go on, Bruce, with your thoughts.
Oh, sure. I just thought it was kind of neat to think about, you know, the double shield of oblivion, and to wrap that thought up, which I know I've talked about on this slot a whole lot. I think it's just an important idea that, you know, the whole outer world, as we think of it, the whole cosmos, I mean, you know, galaxies and quasars and down to quarks, you know, that whole realm of space and time and stuff and bodies and the little separate self we think we are as a little speck within that is just a shield. It's a smokescreen. It's basically a facade behind where ego hides the unconscious guilt. And that's the inner shield of oblivion. That's like, oh no, the outer defenses have been broached. Now I always like to paraphrase Dorothy, you know, what would you do with a mind if you had one, you know? And you know, well, she uses the word brain, I relate to the non-metaphysics there, you know, it's like, well, what would we do with a mind if we had one? Well, the first thing the ego would do would say, get the heck out of there, because that's where the guilt is. And the unconscious guilt about thinking that we somehow pulled off the impossible dream of making up a world of separation. And we think we pulled it off because, damn, it's convincing. You know, what a photorealistic Academy, beyond Academy Award winning holographic movie that we've made up, that we believe in, we identify with. You know, it's to the point where, you know, if you ask the average person on the street corner, is like, do you think you are, you know, pull out your driver's license. Do you think you're the person that you know, reflects the name and photo on this card in your wallet or your purse or whatever? It's like, well, sure, of course. What else am I? Well, you know, the non-dual metaphysics, of course, and other, you know, historically, spiritually, metaphysically oriented systems that address that suggest that, well, maybe we're the decision-making mind that can choose what we want to identify with. And that choice to identify with the outer shield and all of its distractions and firefighting activities and doingness, not that we shouldn't do things, but I need do nothing. That's the emphasis on the word need, reminds us that that's only one of the two choices. The other choice is to step back and say, oh, I could choose peace instead of this. I could choose to look at my mind and look at that inner, you know, bypass the outer shield, you know, go through that basically like a cloud that it really is, but the ego makes it into this impenetrable granite wall or mountain. And then when we get to the mind, that's when ego gets really, you know, shifts from suspiciousness to viciousness, because it's like, oh, okay, now you're on the turf where I made all this stuff up, and I think I'm guilty. I without, you know, the default mode of the ego's thinking is, without looking at it carefully, would have you believe that you pulled off this unimaginably horrific sin of making up a world in which God couldn't exist, in which the perfect peace that we never truly left could possibly exist. And because we believe that, we set into motion this incredibly vast cosmological system that includes the thoughts that propagate into form. And those thoughts are all based on guilt. They're attack thoughts. They're attack thoughts. Yeah, and that's what was the inner shield of oblivion is all about. But they're unfounded. They're unconscious, but they're unfounded. And that's the.
So let us give some. I want to hear some concrete examples of this, because people read this and hear this and talk about this, and they do not recognize that they are doing it or how they're doing it. So concrete examples for me.
Should we start the first paragraph over? Because I think we could do that while we're going through it. How's that sound?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And give examples. I think that might be a good way to address this.
Yeah, because
do you want to reread the first paragraph?
Let's reread the first paragraph. And just think about it in your own minds too, because when we're talking about this guilt, and you say, well, I feel guilty because I separated from God. I'm separate from God and I feel guilty. What does that mean in my daily life? How does that work for me? That, you know, I feel guilty because I see it in every moment of every day of my life. I see it when I'm downstairs making a cup of tea and I turn the water filter on and the water runs through the filter, and then I turn the water off and move the teapot and there's still a little bit of filtered water that's dripping down into the sink and going into, you know, back into the system. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm wasting that filtered water.
Attack thought.
it's a form of vengeance, you know, like these workbook lessons are so sequential, aren't they? I mean, you know, yesterday's, you know, what I see is a form of vengeance. Well, yeah, if we look at it, sure. By default, everything out of the chute, unless we examine it with our inner kindness teacher, with the Holy Spirit in mind, it's going to be subtle or not so subtle, irritation, annoyance, grievance, thought of vengeance. It's going to be something that ego can use as a justification for projection and making it about, oh, it's the other person who did this to me, and which continues to make us mindless, because the only mind that's truly real is the mind that's inclusive. But these little separate wisps of thoughts that you know, essentially divide each other. You know, when we divide ourselves from the seeming others in our world, those are the thoughts that are the attack thoughts. Because if there could possibly be a separate self, it would be at the expense of everything else.
Right.
And that's the logic that the ego doesn't want us to look at. Yeah. And that's our way back. That's the pragmatic, because you ask, well, how do we apply this? What are the everyday practical things? The water dripping, for me the other day, it was like, oh, I noticed there was a towel that I temporarily am here living with my mother in her home in California. And she's recovering from some medical conditions, one of which is a bacterial infection. And so we have, you know, kind of separate towels that we use. And I was noticing that she had one position right next to hanging from a drawer knob next to the sink. And I kept brushing up against it and thinking, oh, I should, you know, should move that. And just for a split second, I was starting to be annoyed. And then I realized, wait a minute, that is something that I made up. Now, it's taken the form of another person who I love dearly, and actually we get along great generally, so it's really, you know, not a difficult thing at all overall. But if I can look at how I made up the most minor irritation, and it really was minor and it was totally laughable, and see that is an attack thought. That's something that I made up to keep me mindless, to keep me fixated on the story of Bruce that has, you know, whatever melancholy or victimhood or, you know, self-pity agenda that has either me as the victim of something outside myself, whether it's a hand towel or an environmental crisis or a financial situation or a health issue or a family or you know, work-related issue, or, you know, it doesn't matter. They're all the same. They're really all the same, but that's not how we think of things. And so we need to use the specifics as they come to our mind. And I think that's where these workbook lessons are so brilliant, is it basically says, you know, look at the stuff in your world. Look at the thoughts about the stuff in your world. And you know, it alternates back and forth between, you know, the eyes closed, eyes open, you know, symbolically the inner and the outer realms, but they're the same because the outer is just a projection of the inner. So either way, we're going to get to it. We just have to look at the stuff that comprises the dream we made up in order to undo it. Because if we go around like Mr. Magoo, you know, without our inner kindness teacher's guidance, we're gonna bump into things, and that's kind of what we do most of the time.
That's what we do all the time. In fact, that's how we recognize what things are, is because we're bumping into it. That's
right.
See,
right.
The only way we know it's there is because we're bumping into it, because we're Mr. Magoo. I love it.
Right.
Me particularly, because I'm almost blind, so I am Mr. Magoo. I feel that way.
Another metaphor I like is this: the invisible elephant in the room, you know, kind of mixing metaphors there. But, you know, the three blind men, or the six blind men, depending on where you read it, and the elephant, you know, each of the blind men, you know, one picks the trunk, one picks the ear, one picks a leg, one picks a tail, you know, that kind of thing, and they're a tusk. And it's like, oh, well, no, it's this. No, it's not that. And they keep describing, you know, because they can talk to each other, but they can't see anything. And they reach out and grab a part of the elephant. And it's like, well, no, it's this. No, it's that. And stop, you're both right. It's a dessert topping and a floor wax, right?
Yeah. And you know what? This is what all the, what do you call them, scientists are doing. Really, mm-hmm. The folks,
oh, yeah.
This is exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. But every time we have a forgiving thought, that we bump up to the invisible, you know, up against the invisible elephant in the room and stub our toe or you know, bruise an elbow or you know, break a fingernail or whatever, you know, we have some imagined slight or insult that occurs from this bumping up against this thing that we don't want to look at. Because it's intentional if we don't want to look at it. And we're willing to look at our rationale and our the purposiveness of it, as you pointed out so brilliantly, Lynn, a few moments ago, that it is purposive. That then reveals to us we're trying to make a big deal out of things that really are inconsequential, but they seem, you know, very, you know, big like an elephant. But every time we forgive ourselves for using ego to reinforce victimhood or you know, make a grievance a big deal, and you know, wah wah wah, we all do it. So don't feel bad if you catch yourself, and I do a lot. Just catch it. Try to shorten the time between the onset of that thought and then the moment when you realize, oh, this is not serving me. I can release this thought. I can
give
that.
Out of the eight.
I can choose peace instead of this. Yeah. And then it's like dabbing a little bit of paint on the invisible elephant. And then pretty soon, you know, you start to see a shape there and you realize, oh, that's just ego's, you know, thought system. And I'm going to walk around it next time. Kind of like in Groundhog Day where Bill Murray, you know, the first time, you know, he steps in the, after he's trying to get away from Ned Ryerson, and he steps across the street into the water puddle, right? In the hole in the road off the curb. And, you know, up to his knee or whatever, ankles, and get soaked. And then the next time, he kind of remembers. And then pretty soon after he's done it a few times, he you know, avoids the puddle. And then eventually he avoids having the conversation with something that isn't productive at all, and avoids the whole scenario. You know, but that's kind of how we do it. Over time.
How he changed that relationship with Ned. How did he change that relationship with Ned Ryerson?
Oh, yeah.
He loved him.
Oh, yeah. Eventually. Exactly. Thank you for bringing that up, Lynn. Yeah, because that's such a great metaphor in that movie, too, which, of course, is a good thing to watch in this time of year when Groundhog Day is upon us in a couple of weeks. So, but, yeah, I mean, we can, you know, give up those attack thoughts by looking at the things that we by default have made to annoy ourselves, and then say, nope, I'm not going there. I'm going to see this differently. I'm going to choose the different teacher. I'm going to choose the thought system of inclusion that says, okay, Ned and I, I'm trying to think of what Bill Murray's character's name was. Phil.
Yeah. Phil, yeah.
Phil, of course. Punxsutawney, as in. Yeah. So if Phil and Ned can realize that their interests are shared, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to buy all of Ned's insurance, you know, which was the example in the movie. But on the level of the mind, we can realize we're all in the same boat. And I think that's what shared interest really is all about. It's not saying I agree with all of your, you know, your persona's individual beliefs about things. No, it's basically saying I agree with everyone on the level of spirit, on the level of the realm where we realize we're all having this massive dream that seems to project a reality, in quotes, where there's separate individuals doing separate things for separate purposes. But the only real purpose that we all share, whether or not we admit it at any given moment, is to get the heck out of here, to escape from the world I see, not physically, but mentally, because that's the only place we can. And that's where the attack thoughts, you know, keep us hostage, and we keep ourselves hostage with
exactly. So we've had some really great examples, the hand towel, Ned Ryerson, and you know, it's the same thing. Everywhere you go, if I go shopping at the grocery store, now it used to be in the grocery store, you just went and picked up a cart, and you know, it could be whatever's been going on. You know, people who've had the bubonic plague have been using that cart, and now you're picking it up and using it, and you're getting all their germs. You're being attacked by them, even though they left the store hours ago. Now, when you get to the grocery store, what do they have at the very front? Things Lysol wipes, or you know,
hand sanitizers.
Yeah. Sanitizers.
Oh, I've got one right in front of me because of my mom's situation. I have them scattered all over the house.
Yeah.
But while I'm doing that, I got to remind myself what a great metaphor. Thank you for bringing that up, because I've been using that over the last few months as a mnemonic device. It's like every time I touch something, that is an example of what is my purpose, and can I be mindful enough to see that I'm investing this with everything I believe it has. You know, I've given this all the meaning that it has for me, like this, you know, not too many workbook lessons ago in the sequence. I've given, you know, whether it's a bacteria, which is really a mental concept, and it's no more or less a mental concept than a body that interacts with bacteria, that it seemed to be smaller, because we seem to have, you know, these visual apparati that tell us, called eyes, that tell us that some objects are smaller and larger, and only because of the relative positions within an imaginary world that we think has properties called space and dimensions, And it just goes on and on. I mean, it's amazing how elaborate the lengths we've gone to to make up a fantasy hallucinated world that is appears to have the capacity to make us feel a certain way.
Yes. Yeah. So the idea for today contains the only way out of fear that will ever succeed. Nothing else will work. Everything else is meaningless. But this way cannot fail. Every thought you have makes up some segment of the world you see. It is with your thoughts, then, that we must work if your perception of the world is to be changed.
Exactly.
That's it. Exactly.
If the cause of the world you see is attack thoughts, you must learn that it is these thoughts which you do not want. There is no point in lamenting the world. There is no point in trying to change the world. It is incapable of change because it is merely an effect. But there is indeed a point in changing your thoughts about the world. Here you are changing the cause. The effect will change automatically. And there's those two thought systems. The thought system of self-interest and exclusion, which is ego's default. And then there's there must be a better way thought system of what the Course calls the Holy Spirit or the Jesus of the Course, or I like inner kindness teacher, but whatever metaphor that relates to shared interest, kindness, what we took with us into the dream to help us remember that we're only having a bad dream about a nightmare about a seemingly separate existence that doesn't fulfill us, doesn't make us happy.
Yeah. Well, and this is a really good example of the thought, the world I see is a projection of an inner condition. That's right. Basically what's happening is I'm projecting my inner condition into the world. And this is why I see all the crap that I see. When my inner condition changes, what I project changes. What I see changes because it's cause and effect. I mean, seriously, it is cause and effect. And the cause is in me. I'm the one who's causing this thing to appear. And as most of us think, the effect is the cause. Most of us say, right. I'm mad because you did this. I'm unhappy because Donald Trump is doing this. I'm worried because my dog is outside. You know, these are all thoughts that are my projections. Right. And coming from my own inner condition that is not healed. And so Jesus has given us an idea of how to see the cause of the world you see is attack thoughts. And if that is the case, then we have to change those thoughts. There's no way around it.
Yeah. And we don't change them by brute force, by taking those thoughts and trying to transform them as they are. It's kind of like Einstein's famous quote of, we're not solving the problem on the level that it was made up. We're basically, by going back to the decision-making faculty in our mind, we're, metaphorically rising above the battlefield of ego's dualistic thinking. And we're looking at, we're using those specifics in order to lift us back to a mindful state. In my case, it's, every time I use the hand sanitizer or go through a doorway, if I think of another exercise or something that triggers a mindful moment that allows me to see, I can choose to see everything that's going on around me and everything I perceive through all my senses and all my imaginations differently. I can see it as a classroom rather than a prison.
Yes. Yeah. And when I do see it as a classroom rather than as a prison, then I recognize that I'm here by choice.
Right, right.
And that brings back my autonomy, my freedom, whatever you want to call it. It brings it back my ability to control my own life. Where on the other way, when you're trying to control your life by controlling all the external factors, then you absolutely have, you're just going to go crazy. Right, and this way, you bring it back to the center. You bring it to your own internal teacher, and from that, you learn. This is how we learn the reality of our situation. And I mentioned a while ago that I thought it was lesson 156, but it was really lesson 152 that has all the tests of truth, basically. And all the, I mean, it's a really kind of nifty little way of recognizing whether or not what I'm seeing or thinking or experiencing is real or true. And of course, you're going to, you know, you'll probably say, well, yeah, you know, it's real simple to know whether it's true or not. But a lot of times, you know, we're so convinced that what we see is true that we don't even stop to question it. And it says, in lesson 152, it says, salvation is the recognition that the truth is true and nothing else is true. This you have heard before, but may not yet accept both parts of it. Without the first, the second has no meaning. But without the second, the first is no longer true. So, truth cannot have an opposite. All right, there's the first test. Truth cannot have an opposite. And it goes on about that. And then he talks about truth cannot change. Truth is unchangeable. So, if it changes, it can't be true. You know, here's these tests. Truth is eternal. If it changes or dies or does not last forever, it's not true. So you have these three things that, you know, if you look at anything that appears to be happening in the world and you ask the question, is this, you know, is what I'm seeing the truth? And you ask the question, does it have an opposite? Is it eternal? Does it change? And if any of those things are components of it, it's not true. So, so then you can go back to the reality here, and then this makes a lot of sense. He says in paragraph 3, the world you see is a vengeful world, and everything in it is a symbol of vengeance. Each of your perceptions of, quote, external reality is a pictorial representation of your own attack thoughts. One can well ask if this can be called seeing. Is not fantasy a better word for such a process, and hallucination a more appropriate term for the result? And yeah, if I'm seeing anything that doesn't meet those criteria of being true, it is a fantasy.
Yeah, and to paraphrase Richard Bach, and we can use those Warner Brothers worlds and MGM lifetimes that are our imagination as the classroom by turning it around. You know, to pull in another cliche from Byron Katie, that we just basically we're going to bring it back inside our mind, recognize that we're responsible, not for the world and in terms of, you know, the weight of the world on our shoulders, but we're responsible for how we see the world, only in the sense that we get to choose which thought system. It's really that simple. It's really just a matter of moment to moment. Am I gonna see this through the eyes of Holy Spirit or through the ego? And if we can remember that and mindfully be gentle with ourselves when we've had long spells of choosing the obviously dysfunctional thought system, that maladaptive one that doesn't serve us. And just say, oh, that was just silly. It's not evil. It wasn't evil, wicked, sinful, you know, because those are the adjectives the ego loves to just heap on anything that involves space and time. Like, because obviously that's what got us into this mess, is that condemnation. So to uncondemn, we have to forgive. And that's, I think, where the three R's come in that the next few paragraphs get into. Shall I read the next one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You see the world you have made, but you do not see yourself as the image maker. You cannot be saved from the world, but you can escape from its cause. This is what salvation means, for where is the world you see when its cause is gone? Vision already holds a replacement for everything you think you see now. Loveliness can light your images and so transform them that you will love them, even though they were made of hate, for you will not be making them alone. And the aloneness, I think, is, because you mentioned the word a few moments ago, Lynn, autonomy. And I think the ego's autonomy is the idea that oh, I can do this by myself. And by ourselves always means at the expense of or not caring about the well-being or welfare of anyone else, But ironically, it also doesn't regard our own seeming separate welfare either, because that's the insanity of the ego. We never are truly happy when we're kind of doing things off on our own, and without the intent to have everyone benefit from whatever decision we make in our minds. And that's so the autonomy of the ego is always a fruitless, ultimately unsatisfying nightmare. But the real autonomy, which really, I guess maybe a better word might be the inclusiveness of the thought system of our inner kindness teacher, is such that our choices no longer are made in divorce from or without regard to the whole, and we don't have to know what's best for everyone. We just have to say, I'm willing to see this differently. I'm willing to be shown, and that's, I think, where these three R's come in again: the reveal, release, replace sequence. You want to read the next one?
Sure. And we don't have to know anything. That's that's the beauty of it, because we don't. It's impossible. This mind cannot know anything. And really, honestly, the human mind is incapable of knowing. It's only capable of and that's the ego mind I'm talking about. It's only capable of imagining and speculating but it doesn't. If it knew, then it wouldn't be the ego.
Right. Yeah.
So it doesn't know. It's just, and it's really not even a being or a person. It is just a thought system. Mm-hmm. And it is the thought system that is built into the script. It's built into the scene the fabric of everything. And in fact, guilt is the very basis of it, of the ego thinking thought system. Every bit of it is built on guilt. Every single bit of the world you see. And if you're looking at this, what appears to be the physical world, every single bit of that is made out of guilt and is only seen because of the guilt that that you experience because of your thoughts about it. And that is really hard to take, and I don't expect anyone to believe it. But once you start actually experiencing that's the truth, you actually see, oh my God, yes. Everything I have was made as a substitute for what I lost when I left the kingdom, and I have to have it, and I have to destroy the earth to get it. I have to destroy everything to get my piece of the kingdom back, and that means I have to mine the earth and drill for oil and use up all the water and destroy the environment and everything to have my little piece of the kingdom here. And you don't see it. You just don't see it until you stop to look. So this is really, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm fighting, not fighting a cold, but I've been attacked by something. Some virus attacked me. So let me breathe a second here, and then I'll read the next paragraph.
Okay.
I have a little Bix device here. It's very cool. It's got a little chamber. You put water in it, and I put some drops of essential oil in it, and heat it up, and then you put this thing over the top of it, and you put it over your face and breathe, and it's pretty cool. It's like a little individual steamer thing. So paragraph 5. The idea for today introduces the thought that you are not trapped in the world you see, because its cause can be changed. This change requires first that the cause be identified and then let go so that it can be replaced. The first two steps in this process require your cooperation. The final one does not. Your images have already been replaced. By taking the first two steps, you will see that this is so. So what are those first two steps? Recognize and release.
Yeah. Recognize or reveal, to identify that it's really identification, really, that we've made, and to notice that we've identified with ego. And by default, that's what we do. You know, that's the we don't even think about it. It's like asking a fish what water is. You know, we swim in it. I mean, it's so entrenched in our thinking that we don't even realize how thoroughly we've identified with the form and the structure and the external, the behavior, all the stuff that, you know, makes up the world that we think we're in is the identification. And we're saying that if I'm this body, if I'm this persona and body, if we, you know, advance it a little bit to something that might include a little mind, then we're basically saying, but I'm stuck to this little seeming fragment of all it is. And that identification is frustrating. That's a terrifying thing that, you know, leads us back into this attack, defense, guilt cycle over and over again. And it's just silly. But once we identify and say, oh, this isn't working for me, I'm not feeling at peace, there must be a better way, that revelation, that revealing process, is always the first step. So that's why I call it the reveal or recognize in the first of the three R's. And then the letting go is is one that we sometimes overlook. Is like, you know, you can't just recognize. You actually have to be willing to forgive yourself, and that's the release, where we say, oh, this wasn't working for me, and because of those things you were just talking about, because our true identity has no opposite, because our true identity is eternal, because our true identity cannot change, that means that I can afford to, and everyone can afford to, because we're all the same being, the same essence, to release that identification. And that release is the moment when we just relax and say, that wasn't working for me, I can let it go. And then, as the Course points out here and elsewhere in the text, like Sam mentioned the first part of our conversation this morning, there's somewhere in the text that goes over this in a different form, but it's basically the same idea. And maybe we'll run across it. We can post it on the blog post when I'm done writing this up. But the replacement is the step whereby we just get the heck out of the way. You know, we don't have to allow truth. We don't have to do anything to make truth, make the truth of what we are already is. So the replacement is just an automatic thing because, you know, like the Course says, it's not about making anything. It's about really unmaking. And the first two steps of the unmaking, we're getting our fabricated world, the outer shield of oblivion, and ego thought system, the inner shield of oblivion, out of the way by releasing ourselves from that identification, the truth of ourselves, which is really a capital S self that we all share, comes to the fore, and we're at peace. And it's like, oh yeah, I've been there all along.
I've been there all along. Yeah.
I just, you know, Dorothy clicks her heels, and you know, she has always been at home. We're just dreaming of exile. You know, it's like the replacement. We don't have to do. There's nothing to do. It's just getting the heck out of the way, you know, moving the ego into the passenger seat, and letting the Holy Spirit, AKA inner kindness teacher, you know, drive. And not and the driving doesn't have anything to do with changing our behavior or changing the activities that we are engaged in. You know, we don't have to go off and live in a cave or you know, change our lifestyle. And you know, those things may change as the manual section says once in a long while, but typically it doesn't. But what we do need to change is how we think about the world. And that's the first two steps of the revealing and the replacing, or the releasing rather, so that the replacement can take place.
Exactly. And to be absolutely cautious or cautious and conscious, I guess, mm-hmm. of expectation.
Right. Right.
Because there's so much, even if I, it's kind of, it goes two ways. One way, and this is the way it's most typical, is I expect everything to go good because I did this, and everything seemed to be going crappy now. What happened? And so that's a kind of expectation that is also setting you up for a big, you know, big fall there. But to only expect to be able to see it differently, because as he says, if you take the first two steps, the images are already replaced. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm expecting still to, I'm going to change my mind about the way that, Richard has been talking to me. However, I'm not going to be surprised if he talks to me like that again. I'm expecting attack by even, and I'm attacking him by expecting attack. And that's the thing. We have to give up expecting attack, and we have to then be looking for the peace that's behind all the attack we think we see.
Right.
Yeah. So for instance, let's get a real world thing, which I didn't even watch, but I've heard a lot about these debates, the Republicans and the Democrats, and they're all debating amongst each other about, which one of them would be the better president. And we're all watching it, or some people are watching it and getting an idea about who they like and who they don't like. Well, recognize this. I'm not going to say everybody does it because I don't know everybody's mind, but Jesus does. And I'm thinking Jesus would say, you cannot watch these things right-mindedly if you're expecting to see attack. And if you are in your mind attacking the characters for what they're thinking, what they're saying, how they're acting, what they're doing, that's a huge attack feast. Just going on. Yeah. I mean, this country is moving into this is going to be an epic attack feast. And it's going to be very difficult not to get involved in it because, you think you have some kind of social responsibility or because, and why is that? Because of guilt. It's really hard.
I'm chuckling a little, because you said it's going to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to get worse. I think it's going to get worse by far. Right now it's outrageous. I mean, I think we're the laughing stock of the world.
Sure.
Right now. In fact, I know we are. I've traveled, I know how people think about Americans. But this is all we're doing. If we're watching that stuff, if we're reading that stuff, if we're thinking about that stuff, and we're making a judgment on who is good and who is bad and what is right and what is wrong, every single bit of that, even the thought that you are the best candidate, is an attack thought.
Yeah. And anything having to do with comparison that makes one or the other a guiding principle, because that idea is the belief in separation. And that, as a former president, speaking of politics, said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. I think Lincoln was on the right track there in terms of his metaphysics,
He was spirit on that, for sure.
Well, he may have been talking on a material level, but symbolically, I think that's actually a pretty cool quote that, we really can't think of ourselves as being a person who is in a position to condemn. And now the judgment is an interesting word, because it's a double entendre. And that's where I think I like, replacing a lot of times the word judgment with condemnation. When I look at what's going on in the ego's mind, in the ego's thought system, as a condemnation, because if we're critical or mean-spirited or in any way taking what we see, whether it's a person or a situation or an environmental condition or a biological condition or a financial condition or whatever, if any of these things that seem to be big deals in our lives, if we can bring those up to mind and say, ah, yes, once again, I've taken my perception based on and motivated by a separate self as having value over, and that identity then becomes something that is at the expense of someone else or myself. If I'm excluded from the feeling of peace or loving kindness or you know, gentle consideration, and then I'm condemning a part of the sonship. And that's what Ken Wapnick rightly points out, is that, you know, that's the most challenging part of this course, is we can't leave anyone or anything out. Now, obviously, you can't invite 7 billion plus people to every potluck you have. But at the same token, the intention, if we're really practicing the course, could be on the level of mind, everyone's invited. You know, that if we're living in a world of symbols, then every person who does show up to our next potluck or whatever we're doing is an emissary that represents all the others. And you know, if there is no opposite, then every seemingly separate person represents all of spirit. That's why I really like Gary Renard's Fearless Love audio, where there's one little idea in there that he suggests as an exercise to see everyone as, when we're mindful, to remember that everyone is not part of spirit, but all of spirit. And I think that's such a huge help to recognize that you know, we're all just dreaming of exile. We're all suffering because of our beliefs, and for no other reason. We're just we're walking around in this paradise with masks in front of our face. You know, just kind of like holding up a placard that paints this horrible world of opposition. But instead of a two-dimensional placard, we're using a three-dimensional holographic projector that we call space-time, and we're using that to keep us mindless, to keep us fixated on this fake dream that doesn't serve us. I mean, we're you know, using these attack thoughts, these facades. Should we try to wrap up the?
Yeah, in fact, I think I'm just going to go to the practice and the last paragraph, because all the rest of this is pretty mechanical.
Sure.
So he says, as you look around, and as you look around, search your mind for as many attack thoughts as occur to you. And I'm hoping that our discussion this morning has stimulated some thinking about, you know, how am I really attacking? And, you know, it's a really... When I started studying, and we can go over a couple minutes, I think, because we're going to meditate here in a couple minutes. But when I started studying nonviolent communication, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you've ever studied that
Marshall Rosenberg's work.
Rosenberg. Yeah. When I started studying nonviolent communication, when Ron Clark first started talking about it, and I said, "Well, I don't need that. I'm not a violent communicator."
Moi. My mind is totally peaceful, of course. I never have any negative thoughts.
I'm not a violent person. And then then I started listening to Marshall Rosenberg, and I started realizing, oh my God, mm-hmm. I am the queen of attack thoughts. Every conversation I have is...
Well, we're all drama royalty. That's the funny part, isn't it?
It's hilarious. Once I realized the extent of my attack thoughts and the depth of my attack thoughts, then this really started having a meaning to me.
Yeah.
But before I really knew or saw, I was thinking everybody else had attack thoughts and I was a peaceful person. You know, I was thinking everybody else needed to clean up their act and I was doing pretty good. And so,
and the humorous part is everybody does that. We all think, oh, it's this other person or this other thing, or these combinations of situations or circumstances that are messing up my life. Damn them, you know?
Yes.
And, but it's basically just the same, you know, dreary, you know, dead horse victimization paradigm thinking that keeps us all enslaved, and it's just silly. Like Ken Wapnick says, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly. You know, why can't we just, you know, gently but you know, steadily release ourselves from this? And that's, I think, where these three R's are so helpful, because we can reveal to ourselves when we're attacking, release it. And then automatically, our inner kindness teacher replaces it with the reality of the oneness that has no opposite, that has an eternal quality and essence to it, and that has no differences and can't change, you know. So
and no opposites.
anyway,
And
well,
no,
thank you, Lynn.
It's not eternal. Yes, thank you, Bruce. God, I love this. And
thanks to all the listeners. And it's such a great lesson, isn't it? Lesson 23, and they're all developmental, and they all build on each other and help us to release those silly things that we've been harboring in our mind that don't serve us.
Exactly. And in what he says here, when you finally learn that the thoughts of attack and of being attacked are not different, you will be ready to let the cause go. So that's it. And so thank you again, Bruce Rawls. And I'm going to hang up from you, and we're going to do a Sikh meditation this morning. I'm doing Sikh meditations on Saturdays. So thank you, Bruce, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Lynn, and thanks all.